Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, what do you have for us?
Well, Aaron, we have a sponsor this hour. It's Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. And right now you can go up there and get a great deal on a tractor or a mower or attachments, you name it. Go up and see them. They also have full parts and service. And they're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Duh. Well, that's fun.
Yeah.
And, well, we survived all our episodes this week.
Well, we had the big Shasta County Fair.
Shasta District Fair.
Oh, Shasta District
Fair. Not to be confused with. So the Shasta District Fair, who could not accommodate a booth for the Catholics.
No, they were.
Though they had massive amounts of space in the building, they could not accommodate them, was what the letter said.
There were some empty spots.
Yeah, like about 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to say.
And then there was a pro-life display at the Republican Central Committee booth.
Yeah, they didn't like that either.
Borrowed from the Catholics since they were banned, and they came scurrying over and banned it in our booth too. So apparently, freedom of speech isn't a top priority there.
No.
But that fight has not ended. So if you live in Shasta County, just keep your ears peeled. We'll be moving forward with that because that's ridiculous. I figure the GOP booth will be banned next year. So they'll just ban us all away.
They're a bunch of radicals, those.
Spoiler alert. I went and talked to a bunch of other vendors and they'd like to have babies at their booth. So I think babies are going to be popping up everywhere.
Yeah.
The stages of life babies, they're just rubber. They're little rubber babies. It shows how big babies are as they're growing. People really liked it. They were super interested. I had pregnant ladies come by showing their other kids how big the baby was. I don't know. Anyway, they said we had their language on the thing. They said we were displaying aborted fetuses. Like, no, that's a totally different thing. And it's icky and scary, and that wasn't happening. So anyway, I was going to do my free advertising of the week, but instead...
you ranted.
Instead, I went full Voldemort and did more bad news. Sorry, inside joke. So, Liam, how are we doing with Greg on the line? Is he on the line?
He's on the line.
Oh, he is. All right.
Good deal.
So before I, did the rundown, I thought I should double check he's in there. So Greg Allison was with us a couple of weeks ago, and we had such a good time. We were like, well, you got to come back. He'll have to come back a lot of times, actually. So didn't want to ruin that for you, but we'll do that more than once. And he is the Alabama State Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's a subject matter expert in avionics system safety and has been active in the aerospace community as an electrical engineer, systems safety engineer, project program manager, team lead, and avid space activist for 45 years. So pretty much he's got 45 years experience more than I do.
Yeah.
He is. He designed the architectural layout of the power and data systems distribution for the International Space Station's nodes 2 and 3. He has designed power and control systems for industrial equipment and worked on the M1 Abrams tank and F-15 avionics. And for the past 20 years, he's been performing avionics system safety for NASA as a contractor employed by Bastion Technologies Incorporated, working on the Artemis 1 space launch systems, X-37, various satellites, and other projects. So the last time we talked to him, we spoke with him about balloons.
Yeah.
And we were chatting about the Chinese spy balloons and stuff, which led us into the electromagnetic pulse discussion and all of that good stuff. And, Greg, it's really unfortunate that your specialty wasn't submarines. You could have probably helped those guys because... Oh wait, I forgot. You're not inspirational enough.
Oh, yeah, that's no problem.
Yeah, you're over the hill.
Yeah.
Too old.
Yeah.
Well, it just so happens I'm a safety engineer, and I would have had some things to say about that.
Yeah.
In the world of safety, you got to have a couple different things: design margin or safety factor, and margin of safety. You got to. That's where, you know, you have the point you designed to. This is how much meat you got to put in the system. How thick your hull's got to be so that it don't get crushed at a given pressure. So you design to that. Then you put a factor of safety on it for, you know, how much more you think you might need to be able to sustain. And so you make it a lot thicker. And hey, this is just part of it. And then you have, so you do that with systems where you can't have redundancy, like a pressure vessel, for example. You know, that's perfect. It's hard to have like two pressure vessels because you're inside one. So you might have two hulls, you know, but that's design margin also, factor of safety. If you had two hulls, both able to take the same pressure, it would be the same thing. But what they had there was one hull. And they already had people in the house. David Lockridge, you know, he and another guy raised issues about this, you know. And what happened? They got fired.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, and one of them even got sued. I think because he probably said something about the hull thickness. He's accused of being putting out proprietary data or something like that. It's insane. You know, that guy also said, you know, basically the owner of the company was saying, safety don't matter. CEO, what's his name? Stockton, I forget it off the top of my head. But anyway, he was saying, safety don't matter. Safety is blah, blah, blah. But he was very dismissive of safety. And you can see he paid for it with his life, but he also took a lot of other lives with him, including a 19-year-old who was really scared to go down. I don't feel missing too much, but it's germane to everything because, you know, safety factors into everything, really. It should be a part of all of our considerations of life, especially if you're doing something uber risky, like going down way below the crush depths that our nuclear submarines can go. This is way below there. They could not go down there. They would be imploded definitely. So you have to build a super strong structure. And another thing in safety is you need redundancy on critical systems. You got to remember what systems are critical for your operation for you to stay alive. And propulsion is probably one of them. like your, you know, status navigation control and rockets, I'm assuming about the same way in the submarine. So there's certain things that are critical systems that you need to have redundancy in, preferably dissimilar redundancy in case you bought the same circuit component, you put it in each of your redundant strings and it goes bad in both, you know, or you do a critical point failure analysis to make sure there's not one thing that can bring down both strings. So there's a lot of little analysis to do, but the importance of that is that if one string fails, you got a backup. Well, maybe you want more than one backup, depending on how long your mission is, how critical it is, how risky. You might want to have a number of different strings. A launch vehicle that we do typically has just one string because the mission's 8 minutes. If you're up in the space station where you're going to be for umpteen months and a long time to rescue, like going down the bottom of the sea, you really want to have about three totally complete operational strings on your redundancy. That's what they should have had, and I don't know they had any at all, other than they did have multiple ways supposedly to float the thing, but if you crush, it don't matter, you're not floating. What happens,
right.
Another thing to consider is composite materials. Composite materials aren't like metals. We're all used to metals. Composite materials are made out of fibers. Those fibers can break individually. And without extensive NDE, non-destructive testing, and I don't know if you could do it on a hull that thick, you don't know if those fibers are broken. Another thing, between the layers, you can get delamination. You don't even know if when you made it, there might, unless you did an extensive NDE on after you manufactured, were there any air pockets in it? And that's a tough thing in manufacturing composites. See, I deal with that. I've dealt with that because we had to do composites in the rockets that I built and flew from balloons. And also as part of the previous program I worked on, when I worked on the solid rocket booster, it had composites inside, you know, we had to put stuff inside of the booster casings so that they wouldn't overheat the shell itself. And then we had the nozzles, which were laid up phenolic composites, and they had to be able to ablate the big nozzles on the rocket boosters. And so, you know, I'm familiar with these kind of things. I know you can get delamination, especially if you got an air bubble in. But see, every time you put this thing under pressure and release the pressure on it, it's going to push in. It's going to give out. That means the layers between them can delaminate over time. Now, reports in the past was that when they went down, they heard loud popping. That was probably either fibers breaking or it could have been delaminating when all that was going on. And it might be, I was told they had sensors. I don't know how you would have looked at that with sensors other than sound. They probably missed it. And so, and every time you stress something like that, you got to where you've made new cracks, made new Metal will crack too, but metal is malleable.
Oh.
It's more forgivable. That's why, you know, you take metal and bend it, you know, and it won't necessarily break. If you bend it enough, it'll break. But you can, but composites are not malleable. They're stronger on a per weight basis, but their strength is like, they might be 10 times stronger on one axis than another. There's a lot of design factors when you use composites, and I would not want to go in submarine made of composites. That is, to me, was to have what to went down to that depth. There may be something running around shallow in the sea, might not be a problem. Going down to such crazy crush depths, I think the whole proposition was insane. And the guy who did it, problem is, here's the problem. We engineers are guilty of one thing. When we design something, it's our baby.
Oh,
it can't
go
wrong because I've looked at everything. I know it can't be bad. It's like Bert Rutan when he did, running the scale composites, this Spaceship One. Look, I got two holes. I've done all this stuff for safety. I'm great. This is the safest thing in the world. Nobody's going to get hurt. And that thing has yet to fly a paying tourist, and it already killed four people. And one of them was one of my friends that got used to work for me, died in a cold flow test because of probably a static buildup charge flowing through composites. So composites bring in a whole new wrinkle, a lot of stuff into your design. And it could just mean the nitrous went into critical overpressure, too. Actually, I got a report on that saying that that could happen. And then we're out in the desert, Mojave Desert, where everything was dry. And, you know, it shouldn't have been in the airport. It was crazy there. But see, people just think, my stuff isn't going to go bad, but it can. And that's one of our problems we think about with our defense. Oh, we got all these defenses, we're good. But you're not looking at where the enemy is looking at how to slip through the cracks. What is it you're not looking for? What is it your defense assets have not arrayed themselves for? And I say this is a segue into the balloon topic. What we talked about last time, well, so I made the following statement, basically. I said that from a balloon launch just outside of our air defensive identification zone, 400 miles out to sea, somebody launching a balloon off a ship could have a EMP device, electromagnetic pulse, and detonate it at an altitude of 120,000 feet. And even if that balloon just went straight up, it was 400 miles offshore, it would still penetrate 88 miles inland and take out everything. Now, chances are, if it's on the side where the breeze is blowing, you get breeze, you get stratospheric winds, it can be up to 200 miles an hour at 120,000 feet. You're probably going to be well inland. But once you get above 80,000 feet, we don't have any fighters that can shoot missiles to hit you or nothing else. Because, you know, we got the operational range, most of our jet fighters is, 60, 65,000 feet. And the AIM-9, which they shot at the other part of balloons. By the way, those jets, that spy balloon was at a lower altitude because you don't have much winds at 56,000 foot altitude. So it was at the slower wind altitude so that it could loiter and spend more time spying on us.
Oh.
That's what they want to fight. That same balloon is capable of going to 30 kilometers, which would have a reach of 420. But I would be more worried about a different kind of balloon, a zero pressure balloon that is cheaper, goes higher, carries more payload, and is going to be harder to hit. And it's easy to launch off of a ship. I've launched balloons off of ships with rockets attached to them. Now, if you attach a rocket to it, you get more cross range. You can take that payload, that EMP device, further inland. Or if you launch it off one of the coasts where the stratospheric winds are blowing against you, you can overcome that and still get way inland with a rocket assist. The kind of rockets I was doing 25 years ago.
Wow.
So the point of this is this. The bottom line is, we don't have a weapon system today. Laser beams are spread too far. Everybody, little lasers, they cut a boom down. No, at that length, you get too much beam spread coming through the atmosphere. The AIM-9s may have a published range of 20 miles, but that's straight up. The motors on them, depending on the variant of the motor, of the AIM-9, which has the Sidewinder missile that we shot those other party balloons down with. One of them was party balloon. $200 party balloon with over $450,000 missile. But anyway, and one of them, they shot two of them.
But who's counting?
Shot two. So, they had $1 million shoot down. That one was probably a Chinese lantern from where I heard it described. But I know whose balloon one of them belonged to. I actually know it belonged to Northern Illinois Bottle Cap Balloon Flight Association. Yeah.
Oh,
friends of one of my best friends. So,
is that for advertising? We are so threatening to the competition. The government shot our balloon down.
Yeah.
It took $1 million to bring our balloon down.
Yeah.
We are so great. You know, they should be able to parlay that into some money. Greg, we have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay.
It is kind of funny, though, $1 million to bring down a party balloon. Oh, my gosh. You're listening to We the People. Let me know you're here, because my TV set just keeps it.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Is your marijuana killing you? A testing of 1,000 NorCal dispensary samples found the majority had toxic mold or substances harmful to humans. As a bud tender, recommended THC products for treatment of medical conditions while you get sicker or exacerbate mental health issues. Get professional medical help and sue the dispensaries for the product and advice liability. Marijuana is not medicine for most Americans, and there's no medicine that is smoked. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Engineer song. Don't do your safety checks. It'll be heaven that finds out about it. So, Greg, with some of these balloons that they're like flying in weapons and things like that on, do we like at what point can we see them? Can we see all these things on whatever it is we track this stuff with? Or, I mean, why do they use balloons? Because they're less expensive?
Well, there's several good reasons for this. One, a balloon is cheaper than a rocket.
Okay.
Much cheaper. A little AIM-9, was almost $500,000. A balloon, that can lift a good-sized rocket. Like I used to buy all those things for $10,000. Some of them more than that. Helium's going to cost for hydrogen. But still, compared to a missile, it's far cheaper.
Yeah.
Far cheaper. And
can you control where the balloon goes, though? We've all let balloons go, and off they. I mean, who knows where they go?
Okay, let me tell you how I used to do it.
Okay.
I used to decide I was going to launch a rocket at a specific point in the sky from a balloon. I could put that balloon right at that very point in the sky.
Really?
All I had to do was launch from sea. I'd do this over the ocean. And I would figure out what time I wanted that balloon to launch, what the winds aloft were, so that I knew if I wanted that balloon in the sky at that point, knowing how that balloon would ascend through the wind profile, I would have to be able to launch that balloon from a certain point at sea. Then I figured out how long it was going to take me to inflate that balloon and which way the wind was blowing. So I would back off from the balloon launch point to a destination in the sea that was upwind, and then I would run with the wind for the balloon inflation time. By the time I got to that point, I wanted to release the balloon would be ready to go. I would release it, follow the winds, and would go to that point in the sky pretty close. It would be within a small margin of error. So, yeah, it's from launching the sea, you actually have a lot of control.
Okay.
So if your objective is that you launch a balloon from a point where it will be carried downwind, you can actually pretty much get it where you want to. I used to tease one of my buddies. He used to would launch one of these balloons, and he would have it land close to his girlfriend's house in Dalton, Georgia. I'm in Alabama, and he'd go out and grab the balloon and go on a date.
See, like balloon for most of us just seems really random.
They're at the mercy of the wind.
Off they go. It's like, oh well.
people aren't expecting what can be done with balloons. That's why this makes a perfect attack platform. You want to attack somebody with something they're not expecting. And we haven't anticipated this. That's why I'm ringing the bell on it, because China's got a huge balloon force. You got a bunch of engineers over there. They figured this out. Because if one little redneck rocket scientist like me can figure it out, I know that with all the engineers I get, somebody over there can think it up, you know, especially when it's out in open literature. So I'm just trying to explain to people on our side. It's quite obvious by the fact that we shoot down party balloons with AIM-9 missiles that our guys don't know what the heck they're doing.
Well,
so that's the proof in the pudding.
Kind of terrifying.
You know, I wrote the white paper for the EMP Task Force on National Homeland Security. And one of the things I put in there was guidelines like, you know, size ranges. If the balloon's underneath these size ranges at altitudes, there's no point in going after it. Like at the spy balloon altitude, it should be as big at least as a bus to be a target. At twice that altitude, it ought to be as long as two buses. Actually, I use for a bus 40 feet, so 40 to 80 feet should be a size range criteria. Now, here's what I would do. I'll be watching for that guy at sea to launch. And when I see a boat running, boats usually going from point A to point B, the shortest distance. They're not trying to chase the wind. If I watch a boat going in a straight line chasing the wind, going exactly the same speed and direction as the wind, something's up. That's not normal. Even if you go in the wind, go the same speed, same direction. Boats just don't do that. Not usually. I would say, I would put some drones up to look for that. In fact, I would use, Predator drone maybe to shoot them down, because these things are going to be at such an altitude that you don't want. Well, if it's got a nuke on it from the MP, you don't be anywhere close to it. So, a General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper Predator B drone would have a could carry quite a payload package of missiles to go after it. And if you had to, you'd ram it into it itself. But there's other drones, too. Right now, the one that's been used a lot for reconnaissance at altitude, they're flying right now over the Black Sea to keep an eye on what's going on in Ukraine, is the Northrop Grumman RQ-4 Global Hawk.
The RQ-4 what?
Global Hawk.
Oh, Global Hawk.
RQ-4
okay.
Global Hawk. There's a new one coming out that's going to be that will outperform it. It's the Northrop Grumman MQ-4C Triton. Now, those aren't missile platforms. Those fly higher. They go about 65,000 feet, so they can be on the lookout for the targets. The Predator drone can also look out, but it can also go in and attack them. But the key to this whole thing is you want to get them before they're high enough to cause a problem. So let me explain the problem. You asked this question earlier, and I kind of didn't get to it.
That never happens to me, by the way.
Oh, okay. Let's say you are in San Diego. You're at a Navy base in San Diego, and you got a big array of radars there at the Navy base, and you're looking out over the ocean to see if the Chinese are coming over the border with one of their bombers or coming over the horizon. Most of those radars are really only good for 250 miles. You're probably 400 miles out. But let's just say you've got a super-duper radar that can see things really well 400 miles out.
Okay.
It's going to be hard to see one of these balloons, by the way, if they don't put metal on it, which they could absolutely do. And they could put radar absorbing stuff on. I covered all that in my paper. They can make it extremely hard to see. But let's say you had the ability to see it instantaneously when it pops up over the horizon, and you're smart enough to not stand around with your thumb in your ear, and say, what is this? What is this? What do we do? What do we do? Let's say you automatically call your fighter squadron and send them out. It's already too late, because that balloon, as soon as it pops over the horizon from 400 miles out, is going to be at 80,000 feet due to the curvature of the Earth flat earthers.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of friends who are flat earthers. They don't believe in that. But no, if you've flown balloons and done art radio stuff and work with aircraft, balloons, you know the Earth's got a curvature. Rockets, you know the Earth's got a curvature. But anyway, so I hate to disappoint people.
Do they really think that? I mean, do people that...
Oh, God, I run into people all the time that think that. You wouldn't believe how many people think that now. It's spreading. It's spreading like the
flat Earth thing?
Don't add the barbarian.
What's the advantage? I mean, like, why spend time on the flat Earth? I mean, like, what do they think is they're gaining by that?
Oh, They believe in the flat earth just because they take some literal, I think, misinterpretation of the Bible, you know. But that, I don't want to go all into that. You know, I believe.
Oh, okay, so it's not a science thing, obviously.
Yeah, no scientists believe it. There's no scientists, no real airmen. I mean,
oh, okay, I feel better now. I was like, oh no, what? Scientists believe it?
No.
Well, they think there's global warming, so I don't, you know.
Let me be clear, the earth is a sphere. Global warming, that's a whole other thing.
It's a whole other problem.
Well, I know John Christie and Dr. Roy Spitzer, and they run the UAH satellite temperature data. And they'll tell you that a lot of stuff we're hearing is misinterpretation.
Yeah, I think.
So, you know,
yeah.
but everybody tells us, oh, so the science is clear. All the scientists agree, and if they don't agree, they work for the oil industry. No, and heck no. I know scientists ain't got nothing to do with oil industry. They're the ones that collect the data, and they don't agree with it. In fact, I know three climatologists. That's all I know. All three of them don't agree with it. So it's like, okay.
You're betting 1,000.
Experts in the field, PhDs, that get to look at the data all the time. They don't buy that, but that's another story.
Yeah, sorry. Didn't mean to rabbit trail you, but that's to me, that's almost as, you know, when you, we learned as kids, there was no end point to science. Science always had ... at the, you know.
Bingo. Science is always open.
If it isn't, you're not doing science.
You come up with a hypothesis, and the hypothesis is a wild-ass guess, It's an informed decision based on some data. It looks like this is the case. Okay, given that, let's prove it. Then you have to come up with a test, and you have to have a control group, and you vary one thing to see if you can make a proof. And then once you've done several tests and proofs and it's independently verified, then you can develop a theory. A theory isn't a wild idea. A lot of people just say, well, my theory is, you don't have a theory. That's just your wild idea. It's not a theory. You know, a theory, and scientifically speaking, now, you know, what layman's parlance, you can call it anything you want to. I believe in freedom of speech, but.
But that doesn't make you correct or, yeah.
Okay, it should be that you form a hypothesis, then you test. It's got to have independent verification. But if anything shoots this so-called theory down, thing, it should be out. But the problem in the world of science, and one reason I don't like this, the science is settled, is I've worked in engineering organizations all my life and other organizations, science organizations, and I know once an engineer or a scientist writes something down, it usually has to go through the management cycle before it gets released to public. And what the engineer or scientist writes based on the data and the engineering they got and what gets out to the public, quite often seldom resembles each other. And when you're in organizations that get your money from promoting a particular political viewpoint, guess what?
Yeah. Suddenly, all roads lead to Rome, right?
Yeah, money muddies everything.
Yeah.
A new quote. Money muddies everything. I just coined that one. That's a good one. So,
and you heard it here first.
There you go. We got a new quote. Everybody use it. Might give me credit on it.
Give us a little hashtag on it so we can be popular.
Anyway. All right, so we coined a new term, the phrase of the call tonight. Maybe we'll change society. At least give everybody a little perspective on that. You got to be able to see through the chaff and all this stuff. You know, I don't hear anybody tell me. I've had kids try to lecture me on this topic. Well, the science is clear. Blah, 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 blah.
Did that work out kind of like what they did with Dianne Feinstein?
Well,
she let him have it.
Oh.
That was like the only, that's the only funny thing I could think of with her was when those little kids came into her office and tried to tell her something about science and she just like let them have it and it all YouTube. Like, Dianne Feinstein was mean to little kids. Like a brother.
Well, you know what that's good for them, actually. We coddle the kids too much. You know,
you can't tell them they're right when they're not. I mean,
one of the things I do is gardening.
And
I know you start plants a lot of times in a greenhouse and get early started on them, but you can't just take a plant from a greenhouse and stick it out in the field or a garden. It'll die. You got to harden it off. You got to slowly introduce it to an interim environment where it gets a little rain, a little more sunlight, more wind exposure to the environment. I put them like under a shade tree on a platform before I put them out in the garden or field, you know, in terms of plants. And it's called harden them off. Kids may do the same thing. You know, they got to have some stress. They got to be used to what the real world's like, or they can't handle it.
Yeah.
So that's actually that can be
hence
a good thing.
Hence the invention of the safe space.
I've been in the military. Drill sergeant should yell at you, make you do push-ups. They should cuss you out and maybe even hit you a time or two. I mean, now that's the offer of boat and all that. You know, how are you going to handle combat when you face an enemy that's going to do far worse to you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and are you going to give up all the secrets of all your comrades, you know, and all your buddies, your squad members, just because somebody frowned at you? I don't know. Boy, what's going to break you? You shouldn't be easy to break. You should be tough. You need to be hardened by off. That's just part of the process. But anyway, that's another story. So back on this balloon thing. Once you're at 80,000 feet, you're already over the altitude that they can take it down. So if they had a transporter, if they had their jet sitting there, ready to go, and the pilot sitting in it, ready to go, everything's loaded up, and he was in a Star Trek transporter that could put him immediately at his operational flight altitude, right below that balloon, which we know it's not the case, it'd be out of range.
Uh-huh.
If he had a 20-millimeter cannon, at best, they might get another 10,000 feet up above, but, you know, this balloon's at 80,000 feet already. If he had an AIM-9 missile, they tell us it will go 20 miles, but the motor on it's only, depending on the variant, only burns for like 5.4 seconds to 6 seconds. Going straight up, it'll only get about 10,000 feet. And then you just don't have the mass fraction. You need to get the altitude mass fraction. Rocket parlance is the ratio of fuel to the ratio of the total mass of the system. So the higher that number is, the higher it's going to fly. Providing, you know, of course, for a rocket to fly, thrust has to exceed weight. That's the other thing. But the situation is that they're not going to get to those altitudes of those missiles. And if they were sitting right under, but they won't be. By the time they get out there, it'll be at 100,000 feet, maybe 120 already. And the sad thing is, if they could take it down, it'd probably take them out too if it's got a nuke on board. We've got to have other means to stop this. Now, what I would say is it's all reliant on immediate detection. That's why I say I think you might want to put a Northrop Grumman MQ-4C out there, the Triton, or a Northrop Grumman RQ-4 Global Hawk. I think we ought to come up with other platforms eventually that fly higher and are cheaper and longer-range flights, like the Zephyr drone or something like that down the road. We need to come up with other stuff that will do the looking. But you need something to carry missiles or some way to deal with it, and it needs to be a drone. And the best one out there that's currently available is the General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper, which is also known as a Predator drone, or Predator B. There's different Predator drones. Predator B would be the best one because it can carry a lot of missiles. It's also got a side aperture looking radar, and it's got a camera on board. And some guy can be sitting at the console back at the base doing all the stuff. You know, and they don't have to be there on site in case this thing goes boom. The reason I worry about going boom is because, you know, a lot of people say, well, just EMP it. Well, what I fear is they will make these things where the whole thing is reliant on a wind-up timer to release the payload, which would be the EMP device. And as soon as it gets an acceleration on it, it'd be an accelerometer trigger.
Oh. So it starts falling.
It goes boom. So once you shoot it down, it just decimates.
Sure.
So that's how they could come up with a way to get around. Oh, we shot the balloon. It's coming down. It's great. Well, no, because it's already close and inland. It's too close. You're already going to get everything fried. So even if you successfully shoot the balloon down, it still has a successful mission because it goes boom and takes out everything for miles and miles and miles inland. Maybe it's close enough that it'll take 300 miles of stuff out inland. And everything on our shore, I mean, we got most of our military bases, most of our cities, most of our industry, our trade, our ports, airports, all kind of stuff out on the shore.
If
somebody had a couple of these ships on the East Coast, a couple off the West Coast, and a couple in the Gulf of Mexico, that could devastate the entire United States, especially if a few of them carry rockets, the ones that's, you know, not down, you know, upwind from their targets, because they're upwind the targets, which is naturally going to drift over the target. So that's the way they could totally obliterate the United States with the MP tax on a balloon. And you probably would never see it in the first place.
Well,
watch it.
We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, I'm kind of curious, like, what, how do they, I know this isn't what they do, but, you know, I'm not a balloon expert, right? So how do they drive the balloon around? Like, how do they make it go where they want to go? Maybe when we come back, you could give us a clue on that, because honestly, balloons seem so random, and you're telling us how accurate they can be. I'm really curious how you control where they go and how they get there, because we've all seen those things, like, where people go on a balloon ride, and they wind up somewhere, you know? It's like, oops, we didn't plan on that. Drop the sandbag, and whoosh, off they go. So our guest today is Greg Allison. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? We could float among the stars together, you and I. For we can fly. Up and away.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know that the marketing of marijuana is a misogynistic and racist activity? That's right. Most marijuana corporations are owned and controlled by rich, fat cat white corporate types, and most dispensaries are placed into depressed communities of color. These communities can least afford the chains of drug addiction and corporate greed. For more information about marijuana, please visit sources like ALM, Americans Against Legalizing Marijuana, at www.aalm.info. And remember, let's be careful out there.
The world's spinning round like a loony balloon, heading for a collision with Saturn and Mars. And we're narrowly missing the man in the moon, spinning out of control, crashing into the stars. Have we all lost our gravity, reason and sanity? Is this the price that we pay? Have we all lost our way on this loony balloon?
That would be like the Flat Earth Guys song you could play for them. They might like that. I think the Kinks might have been ahead of their time. So how do they make the balloon go where they want it to go?
There's three things to bear in mind here. Most of the balloon's going to follow the wind. Now, we've got good atmospheric models out there. You know where the wind's blowing. And you can even send up a trial balloon.
Yeah.
little weather balloon.
The proverbial trial balloon?
Yeah, a literal, real, honest-to-God trial balloon. So this is one of the things you can do. So if you do like I did, and let's say you want to target a specific place that you want this balloon to detonate, and let's say if I want the center of this detonation just, 300 miles offshore of North Carolina, California, 250, 300 miles. I can start out, like I get further inland than that. I can depend on the winds aloft. I could start out 400 miles outside the ADIZ, that's the Air Defense Identification Zone. I could, pick my point for the release of the balloon. And of course, I could back figure, how long it's going to take me to inflate it, and where the winds are on, the surface winds are blowing. And I could start my boat up from that spot and be ready to release it when I get to the spot that the winds need to pick it up from. And then it would float upwards, and then I know what the winds aloft are, so I know where that point in the sky would be, a point chosen, so that the airstream would take it over the intended target. So if I wanted, I could do this. If I wanted to target San Jose, San Francisco area, that's kind of, in the middle of the state of of California. I could take out everything from San Diego. I could take out every major city in California, every major military base, and every major city from this one EMP device.
What the hell? So is the balloon the size of a minivan, the size of a skyscraper, the size of a lunchbox? Like, how big a balloon is this?
This balloon would probably be about 80 feet, 80 to 100 feet, by the time it gets altitude. A lot of times it gets up to 120,000 feet, maybe, a little over 100 feet, 100, 120, something like that. But it would be small when it starts out, because at 100,000 feet, the atmosphere is only 1% as thick as it is on Earth. You know, for all intents and purposes, we'd call that a vacuum, which happens to be the same as on the surface of Mars. You fly a helicopter on Mars, just blows my mind.
Yeah.
But they do it. That's an engineering marvel. That Martian helicopter thing. So That means if the atmosphere is 1% acidic with zero pressure balloon, like I'm talking about using here, it would have to expand 100-fold the time it reached that altitude. Now, the other kind of balloon, what we saw, the Chinese spy balloon, was a super pressure balloon. It keeps the same outer envelope, but it's got an inner envelope that expands as it goes up inside the outer envelope. It's called a ballonet. That's where the lift gas is. And they can have atmospheric gas in that outer envelope if they want. They can pump in and out as a form of ballast, actually. They can set those balloons, depending on how much air they put in that inner envelope and how much payload they put on, how much lift gas they put in. They can set it to go whatever altitude they want to fly it at. So for the loiter balloons, they flew those in the 60,000-foot range because there was almost no wind. There was very little wind. So they got a lot of loiter time going over the targets that they could spy on. But now, what I'm saying is, I could pick a point, float this thing over, and it would detonate and take out everything that I wanted to take out easily without any further control. But now, how do you get control if you want other control? Well, there's a couple ways to do that. So what I meant, first point was pick your launch point and know the wind's aloft. The second thing is to catch the winds that go in the direction you want them. One is what normal ballooners do, which means that you can carry extra ballast up and then drop off ballast to go to a higher altitude and get winds aloft that are higher going in the direction you want to go because different winds go in different directions. Or you could vent a little lift gas and drop back down to catch a lower wind. If you got like a hot air balloon, like people ride on, you can control that by how much flame you throw up into the envelope of the balloon, with your gas burners. But and we're not talking a gas burner hot air balloon here. We're talking about something that's way higher, way, way higher. And so the lift gas is going to be helium, which is expensive now, or hydrogen. Hydrogen is typically explosive, but it's a lot better lift gas. And now it's cheaper. And really, you shouldn't have any problem with it, if you're launching from the deck of a boat, as long as, nobody's smoking right next to it. Let's get altitude.
So the balloon is still its forward motion is always controlled by the wind. Do you have the ability to turn it?
Well, yeah. Let me go into that. So in general, a balloon follows the wind. But picking the right winds and or using ballast, you can control which wind you catch. All right. So I mentioned two ways to control it. One is pick your launch points and know the winds aloft to get it where you want to. Two is by controlling the ballast and lift gas. Three, all right, now we're going to look at another thing. The Chinese spy balloon had onboard propulsion. And it takes some pretty good propulsion to overcome the winds to any degree. Now, at the loiter altitude, that's easier to do because the winds are lower. So it had propulsion. It had these huge solar arrays on it, so it probably had most likely propellers of some kind or array of propellers. That's what I think it probably had. Another way this might be through electrostatic ion wind generators, something that a lot of people in the UFO community like call lifters. They're really just something that accelerates ionic air. I've played around with these. They move a lot of air. In fact, some of your air filter devices use that as a method to suck air through and blow it out. There's no moving parts. You might have seen them. I think it was maybe the Dyson fan has one of those in it. I don't know. But anyway, and there's an aircraft that somebody's just recently invented, a little drone aircraft that are flying around with this kind of technology. So that might be another way. Have some onboard propulsion, but that works best where the winds are lower. Although it could work otherwise, but not as much. Now, if you had like a dirigible or an airship with some serious motors on it and you got a pointy nose and it's long cigar shaped, then your wind profile is a lot less for your wind gas, and it's easier to steer around. Now, also, you can control the payload package by having a payload package that can steer. And to do that, you can have a cold gas reaction control system. They're just little thrusters that just blow air through it, basically. We use pressurized gas on one that we put up with what we call the balloon launch return vehicle. We built a lift body that was remote controlled and rocket launched and put a boat on balloon. I did this for $70,000 back in 1928, 25 years ago. Yeah, so this is one, and because it had a pilotable, remote pilotable lift body on it, we could have steered this thing and got a lot of cross range and flew it to where we wanted to go. If it had a nuke on it, see, we could have flown it right over any kind of weapon system. We could have flown it right over the target, even if we had to go against the winds. So if I was on the, say, the winds at balloon altitudes, yeah, once you get up, you know, over 80,000, 100,000 feet, they have a particular direction. Most of the year they blow from the west to the east. And a little bit more stable than the jet streams that the aircraft fly in. And a little faster. And but there's two times a year that wind stops. And it's called spring and fall turnaround. So it's just like almost dead quiet up there. You can float a balloon straight up and it'll just hover in one spot, which would be great for an MP platform. Be great for attacking from both all coasts because your balloons will stay in the one spot. And you can have all coastal systems attack without any other assist mechanism needed. Now, if you wanted to fly a balloon, say, from the east coast when the wind is blowing from the west, then you'd put a rocket assist device on there or something like I flew, maybe a drop vehicle that has a glide profile. Like the hypersonic glide vehicles, which Chinese have already tested dropping those in balloons, so that's kind of weird. They're already looking at weapon systems and balloons. They've done drone drops. They've done these hypersonic-type-looking vehicle drops. They're definitely and they set the design point on that spy balloon to be able to take 1.1 tons up to 30 kilometers, which is about 90,000 feet. So they've already experimented with developing the systems for delivering EMPs. And that, the fact they picked that altitude, because that's pretty much an optimum altitude for an EMP to cover. If you get below that, there's some people that say that the EMP won't be as effective once you get below 30 kilometers. But I know some physicists who say that's not true. But that's what's in some of the literature. So they set the design point that balloon go 30 kilometers screams EMP to me. So they but we, the one we saw wasn't at 30. But that one balloon type is actually designed to be able to reach 30 kilometers. So yeah, what was it going with steering the balloons? Okay, so now we've covered three methods. So we're picking a launch point, ballast. And also, we've covered the propulsion. We're really four, because then we've talked about having a package you can steer around. So if you get a rocket, you give it a kind of an assist by pointing along the way of the vector you want to fire it. And, you know, just that rocket assist. Now, what I was saying is the winds blow from west to east, and you got this turnaround in spring and fall. Well, in the summertime, the winds go from east to west, the turnaround.
Oh.
The turnaround is the time when the upper atmosphere at the balloon altitude, 80,000 feet above, are getting ready to blow the other way.
It's so funny, you know, and for the rest of us, we all think this is just so random.
No, it's not so
apparently
random.
Apparently it's not so random.
If you know what the winds aloft are, and if you can control your launch point on the surface of the Earth, which you can absolutely do with a ship, then you can put that balloon where you want it, when you want it there. And that's really all it takes for an EMP attack, just knowing where you want that balloon to be. And that's why I don't think we'd see this Chinese spy balloon. I think we'd see a zero-pressure balloon. They're cheaper, they fly higher, they're easier to inflate off boats. I've done it. You can do the super-pressure balloons off boats. But the only reason to do those is because they can stay aloft for months. So if you want something to go all the way from China to the United States, that's what you would use. If you want to be able to fly from, if you're just going offshore, and your mission time's only going to be at most 3 hours. So given that, you see, you could absolutely do the launch, and the whole mission time is short. So the zero pressure balloon is all you need. And it gives you better performance, lower cost. That's exactly what I would expect them to launch if they were going to attack us. But the good thing about that is, if you got those drones up looking, if they got some AI software on them, and they see boats out there going in the same direction and speed as the wind for, say, several minutes, you got an alarm right there. And so we should be able to detect them. But the key thing is, we got to have the right assets in the air at the right time, looking and knowing what they're looking for. And we got to have some means to take it down before it gets high enough to do any damage. And so that's why the Predator drone would be perfect, even though it only has an operational ceiling of 50,000 feet. If you let it get over 50,000 feet, you're going to get in the trouble zone already. So you need to be able to catch it from the get-go.
Yeah, because if it's up that high, it's over your, it's closer to the target, and then you run the risk of wrecking everything on the ground.
Right. Now, if there's a Chinese spy balloon coming from China that they've set at the operational altitude of 30 kilometers, you're going to have a hard time hitting it with anything, but you're going to know it's coming for a long time if you've got, you know, assets in the ocean monitoring for it, which you should have. I don't want to say we will, but we should. We need
how,
to make
how do you how do you think it. The Chinese got that balloon clear over the United States undetected?
Well, we detected it. Apparently, they claim the United States knew it was there when it got over Alaska, and some people said they saw it over the Pacific, Hawaii, but it went up over Alaska and drifted down. We weren't announcing. Somebody in Montana started taking pictures about it and yelling about it and publishing it. And look, we got, what is this thing?
Wow.
Then they couldn't deny it. They might have just let it flown over if nobody, and people would have seen it when it got more populous areas. But they might not have had a clue. Probably would have generated some UFO reports. I've done that with a few of my balloon plots. So, especially when it came down a lady's backyard, we had an oxidizer tank we were flying to test. Could we keep the pressure 750 PSI so we'd have enough pressure for our nitrous oxide in our rocket motor? And we had a big pink package on a big silver balloon. It had a big beeper on it to make it easier to look at. So it was going beep, 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 beep. And then coming down this woman's yard again in northwest Georgia. And she called up the local sheriff. She said, there's a UFO landing in my backyard. Y'all come get this thing.
And you're like, leave my UFO alone. we totally want to know, too. We absolutely want to know. If what you know about the UFO thing, we have inquiries coming in as we speak. We've got to take a quick break for the news. We're going to come back with our guest, Greg Allison. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Doing bad things to you.
The second half of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and I am a host, and my views are the
the views
topic.
Of the host. I know the disclaimer at the beginning always makes it so like, yeah, we're just going to talk like, crap the whole time.
Yeah, really. What, you don't want to believe anything I say? What?
Come on. It's true.
Hey, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And they're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, right in between the Oasis Road and Pine Grove exits.
Next to the pencil, but not the eraser.
Not the erasers. There you go. So go up and see them if you're looking for a tractor or an implement or a mower. They've got a pretty good inventory right now. Mowers are getting a little skinny. It's late in the season, and mower sales are pretty much over. But go up and see what they've got and get a great deal right now. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can go online and get on the interweb. And
an interweb one day. One day, Bill's going to get the interweb.
Yeah,
all you're going to hear is, and that's it.
Interweb. www.papemachinery.com.
Okay, the part they needed spelled was Pape. It's P-A-P-E.
Yeah, they got the www.
Yeah, they got that part.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go.
Yeah, there you have it. Simple. Simple. Anyone could do this. Even us.
Yeah, even the hosts that have no opinions.
I tell you what, you get tired and everything seems funnier.
Yeah.
Some people get tired and they get all grumpy.
Yeah.
I don't know, everything just seems funny to me when I'm tired. So, Mr. Allison, back to you. And you're funny, so you were really... I knew you were on today, and I thought, oh, that's so perfect. We're going to be super tired. And he is so much fun. Oh, my gosh. I pulled up the archive, and I was listening the other day from a couple of... when we had you on a couple of weeks ago, and I was kind of cracking up. You remind me of the guy that's on Skinwalker Ranch, the science guy.
Oh, I know him.
Travis Taylor.
Travis Taylor. Do you know that guy?
He's a buddy of mine. Yeah, I know him. He's a buddy of mine.
Oh, my gosh. I knew it. I'm like, they've got to be connected, because last time
you... He wrote me, get this.
Yeah?
He wrote me into doing a Nat Geo special on alien invasion of Earth.
Outstanding.
Oh, yeah.
When I heard his solution, I said, I'm actually in the background watching Blitz, but when I heard his solution... before it came time to interview me, I walked off.
We got your back on that one. If you want to float that, you know, on kind of a test plot.
Is that like a balloon pun there?
Yeah, there's a little balloon pun there.
Yeah.
I want to float it. I'm sending you an email that's got a link to my Galactic Greg's channel and some videos from the Galactic Greg's channel, and also links to my Green Greg's channel and the balloon battle top videos I just posted on there. So you've got... those are also on Galactic Greg. So I've got I've got my prepping, gardening, worm herding channel, Green Greg's, which has evolved more into a prepping news channel. And then that's just G-R-E-G-S on YouTube. And then I've got this space channel on YouTube. It's called Galactic Greg's. Now, unfortunately, there's several other channels that's got a very similar name. So it's Galactic.
I linked those. I linked those on our page. I put the link to the page, but if you send me specific videos, I'll hook those videos onto today's.
I just did that.
Okay.
From Galactic Greg's, I sent you a link to a video on anti-gravity research.
Nice.
And I sent you also a link to a video on multiple balloon launches. There's a one-hour video I did just a week and a day ago.
Okay.
Saturday last week. Eight balloons were launched from the Climate Center at UAH, same place that we were at doing this video with Travis Taylor, believe it or not.
Okay.
A little different area of that place, but not far from it.
It was funny because we were watching Skinwalker Ranch and we were listening to Travis Taylor, and it's like, he sounds just like Greg Allison. It's like, well, everybody who lives there who has the same accent probably doesn't know each other. And then we thought, wait a minute. They're all scientists. They might know each other.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I know.
Is he a fun guy? He seems like he would be a gas.
He's fun. He's fun. He's crazy.
Yeah. He seems just really fun and smart. Because give me the stat again. You told us about scientists in Arkansas. What was that stat again? About how many like PhDs are in your state and all that?
Oh, not Arkansas, Alabama.
Or Alabama, sorry.
Yeah.
It's the other A state. I skipped Alaska.
Yeah. The Huntsville, Alabama area has more engineers per capita than any other city in the Western world. It's got more engineers per capita and more PhDs per capita.
In Huntsville, so not in the state, in that town, in that city.
No, it's in this area.
No fooling.
This city, this area, metro area, has more engineers per capita and more PhDs per capita. So you got a lot of brain power in this town. If you want to do something engineering, if you want to have a workforce to support you, this is the place to do it. You try to do it somewhere else, you're going to have a hard time pulling enough engineers in, unless you're already in the engineering tech area. But also the cost of living here is low compared. It's way lower than California.
Everywhere. I mean, you could live on the moon cheaper than you could live here. Yeah. I mean, even with the ride.
And we don't have all the regulations, and we can pack these.
Hey, come on. We love our regulations. You know, we just sit here and we wait until Gavin Newsom tells us what to do. And then we move.
He's got a new one every day, don't he?
Oh my gosh. They come up with some of the stupidest stuff, and it's like, how are you actually going to enforce that? You know,
yeah, or pay for it.
You know, the stupid stuff. Like, there's tons of stuff, and you're like, you can't even enforce that. You shouldn't make rules you can't enforce, otherwise they're not real. I mean, you learn that with your kids, and I don't know. Yeah.
Well, in 1983, I started a chapter of the L5 Society. A society, it was my third chapter I started, actually. I started one in North Carolina. I started one in Alaska. And this chapter is the L5 Society was the society that formed to disband. That was their goal, to disband.
Okay.
You ever heard of a society that formed to disband?
No, not recently.
Well, the object
they were successful.
The object was disbanded at a human colony in space at the L5 point. So I won't get it all into what L5 means, but so the situation is that it was a space settlement society, kind of way out there.
Okay.
Not so much that today. The stuff we've been pushing for is coming around, starting to happen. But I've been president of chapter. It's 40 years this year. So I've been president of chapter for probably 22 years of its history.
No kidding.
I spent a long time as president. Now, I wasn't president when I did this video. I became president again for another year after that. But I've tried to hand it off to the younger people to run it. But anyway, so this, and I also was an officer in the National Space Society, which the L5 Society and National Space Institute merged and became the L5 Society.
So in Huntsville, in your Huntsville area there, do your volume of engineers there, do they come from there or do they come from elsewhere and live there?
Well, it's
probably a little both.
We've got a lot of people here that have been inspired to follow. I grew up on Sand Mountain, which is about 70 miles southeast of Huntsville, rural. Grew up on a farm, but, you know, I was always inspired for space and things like that. So it was kind of normal, natural for anybody in the area that has an inspiration toward engineering for any reason to gravitate on in.
Huh.
But we get a lot of people from outside. Huntsville is, in the context of Alabama, is a lot more metropolitan than most of Alabama.
Okay.
So whatever that means, for whatever that is or isn't worth. But it's still got a Republican mayor. And so that's why Huntsville's growing like crazy.
Because he's not telling you what to do every minute of every day.
Yeah, we went last
a clever
year
idea.
From being the third largest city in Alabama to being the first in 1 year.
Wow.
So, you know, you
doing
you
something
find,
right.
Yeah, look what's happening to Portland, Seattle, and
San Francisco.
Going to heck in a handbasket, you know. San Francisco, you know, businesses are pulling out because they don't like the idea that people can just come in and rob them and get away with it. Bad business environment in these other areas. L.A., I haven't been to L.A. now in about 10 or 15 years, but I used to go out there a lot, and it used to look really great. And last time I went out there, I was like, ah! So, I don't know.
Well,
but anyway, I've seen decline in certain areas. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. We've experienced the decline in certain areas. We live in far northern California, so we don't have a lot of the stuff that, I mean, they're not going to show our area on the news, but boy, you know, they're always coming after our water. And the more we, quote, manage our forests, which, of course, is not what's happening, but the more we do that, the more they catch on fire. And believe it or not, they try to blame it on climate change.
They wouldn't catch fire so much if properly managed.
Right, but you know, instead they just...
I saw a study that claimed the Native Americans actually managed the forest and did a lot of little burns to keep them from having big forest fires.
Well, they did, but they didn't let them... we've been suppressing fire for 100 years.
Yeah, well...
And then light a fire? Well, different
they
outcome.
They actually would start little fires back, you know, before things got out of hand, you know.
Right, but it's going to take a long time to get to a point where that's going to be okay.
In Alaska, the forests up there are a fire ecology. A lot of the seeds won't even activate unless they get burned by fire.
Right. So problem is our fires here are so hot that it burns way down into the ground. It just sterilizes everything.
That's because you let everything grow too long.
I know. It's something we fight all the time. But it kind of always comes back to more bad science. I mean, we have these
people.
Well,
the do-gooders are often doing bad in the name of doing good. You know, they lose all sense of what things really are. So you're in a farming community, right?
We have lots of farming and ranching. We used to have a lot of mining, and then here's some more bad science. We should have a bad.
Well, I hear a lot of tractor ads, so
we should have a more bad science a show about all the bad science. But yeah, they decided with mining, suction dredge mining in particular, that it put mercury into the river. And it's like
by sucking out minerals,
by removing the mercury, they were putting mercury into the river. It just, they just come up with it. So they banned it, and now the riverbeds and the streambeds don't get turned over. I mean, the fish used to follow the suction dredges because through the material that was being sucked off the bottom, the fish couldn't get it. It was all under the rocks, so it was like a giant food blast.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of people who were retired. They were hobby miners, for a lot of years, and they'd retire, and that's what they would supplement their Social Security with, because they'd find a lot of gold out here. And
so have they been prohibited from doing that?
Yep. They banned it. So
basically, they want to ban you from doing anything except sitting on a sofa and playing with a game, picking up on game control that submarine used.
Yeah, back to the game control that the submarine used. Yeah, and bad choices and bad science. No, true story. We have a friend. He has a ranch, and they were banning lead ammunition because it was toxic. And so
they're trying to do that on all the national parks and all the national forests now.
He took a hunk of lead down to Sacramento and put it on the legislator's desk, the guy that wrote the bill, and he said, "You know what that is?" And the guy's like, "No," because it's lead. And the guy like leapt back like it was gonna, I don't know, do something to him.
Radioactive.
And he says, "Where did you get that?" He said, "From my ranch." And he goes, "What?" He said, "You do realize it comes from the ground, and it's on the periodic table, and it's a natural element, right?" And, I mean, this guy, he goes, "Where did you think it came from?" The guy thought lead came from a factory.
That's where food comes from.
Yeah, like milk and eggs and cheese.
Yeah,
and
it just came from a factory, and I thought, what the hell? It kind of... We talked to Patrick Moore a few years back, and the guy that bailed out of Greenpeace, and he said he bailed out of Greenpeace because they wanted to ban chlorine, and he tried to explain to him it was an element on the periodic table. They had no idea what he was talking about, and he quit. I was like, poor scientists.
For municipal water, if you don't want to be drinking a lot of E. coli, it's got to be in a municipal water system. Now, the fluoride is a different matter. There's no use for fluoride.
Yeah.
Other than to make us all docile, so we'll follow what Uncle Sugar tells us to do.
Exactly.
But when you want Gavin Newsom, what can I do for you?
Yeah, Uncle Gavin.
You'll set as a docile little dope playing on your video games and do nothing else.
We totally want to hear more about the UFO thing. We swerved in, taking a little detour from the balloons, etc. But we've had some people say, like, "Well, he studies all this stuff. He knows all these people. Like, what's he know about the UFO thing?" Like, so.
Okay.
Anyway, we have inquiries, but we have to take a really quick break. And so we have a nice Weird Al song when we come back that should work us nicely into the UFO thing. We'll be right back with our guest, Greg Allison. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head, the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along that he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought I was crazy, but I'm not. Oh no. My analyst told me that I was right out of my head. He said I'd need treatment, but I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined, when out of his sight, to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts, no more ifs, or ands, or buts. They say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas, but I knew what was happening. I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Oh, by the way, I've cracked the code. I figured out the shadow organizations and the Illuminati know that they're finally primed for world domination. And so you've got coming across the border, puppet masters for the new world order. Be aware, there's always someone that's watching you. And still the government won't admit they fake a whole moon landing. Thought control race, psychotronic scanning. Don't mind that, I'm protected cause I made this hat from aluminum foil.
Foil.
Where I had this foil lined in case an alien's inclined to probe your butt or read your mind. Looks a bit peculiar. Seems a little crazy, but someday I'll prove there's a big conspiracy.
Ah, boy.
Yeah, it's just the first music.
Oh.
That's crazy.
I never played that one when Dr. Pry was on, because I wasn't sure we had gotten to the level of funny with him that would allow that.
he might have had a hard time with it.
It took us a while to edge into some of it, but I know he was laughing on the inside. He was one of those people who laughs on the inside, which I don't understand. It makes me kind of nervous. Sometimes he laughed on the outside.
Laugh out, yeah.
But I was like, our new best friend, Greg, he would like this.
Alrighty, so I sent you a video on anti-gravity research, and this lady, whose name was Amy Eskridge, she had started an institute for exotic science. The whole purpose of this was to be able to fund projects that wanted to look into alternative propulsion technologies. And she, what we call breakthrough propulsion technology, and Marshall Space Flight Center actually got involved in it at one time. So it's one of those things that you think would have a big giggle factor, especially among a bunch of serious engineers. But if you look at this video, this room was packed full of engineers.
Okay.
Aerospace experts, many of them many decades up on the ticker clock. And nobody in there was giggling. Everybody was having very serious conversations with her. She was kind of going through a review of the many different projects that a lot of different people have done in the past. I think talking about Rolfe and Merritt's, and some of them weren't meritorious, but there was a survey of a lot of the different different alternative breakthrough propulsion efforts through a lot of individuals have tried to launch over the many years. Well, it was almost impossible to get public funding for these things. If you hadn't get successful, it would probably go black, or maybe somebody would eliminate you if you got too close to something. There's been a lot of people scared of the work in this realm. And so she was trying to come up with a means to actually fund people that was independent of all the other things that would encumber them. And a lot of very serious discussion amongst a good crowd of engineers on this topic that would seemingly have a big giggle factor, but nobody was giggling.
Uh-huh.
So I highly encourage everybody to look at this video. What this suggests to me is that it's not outside the realm of possibility. I mean, some of these projects were like a century ago almost that some of this stuff got started. It's not outside the realm of possibility that somebody somewhere might have cracked the case on how to do this kind of propulsion. Now, there's objects seen in the sky that they're having a hard time with conventional, aeroplane technology, explaining how they move why they're quiet and how they can zip back and forth the way they do. And so that's got a lot of people mystified. It's, like I said, it's not outside the realm of possibility. Somebody on this planet is doing this. Some organization, some government, maybe our own government. A lot of us think that our government may have something that's tightly in the wrap, so tight that they don't even let the normal space people know anything about it. So the normal space people have been trying to come up with their own way to crack into this. So that's kind of the backdrop on that video, and it's a very interesting video. So it's I highly encourage people to go check that out.
And tell me the name of that one.
Okay,
because I've got this whole list. I want to make sure I put it near the top. I was pulling them all over onto the.
The one I sent you is called Anti-Gravity Technology Survey.
Okay.
Rest in peace, Amy. Unfortunately, Amy passed away.
Oh, okay. So it was one of the top ones. All right, I'll make that at the top of the page. I'm loading them now.
No longer with us. She was a young lady, young, attractive lady, really smart, but she had some health issues, and her life is over, unfortunately. So no, the government didn't take her out. So, not a conspiracy. She just
take the foil out of your hat.
She actually has an auto ending to her life. Unfortunately, she was having a lot of pain.
Poor thing.
So yeah, sad, really sad.
Yeah, we could use all the smart people. Obviously,
yeah, she was brilliant. Had a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy, but she had extreme health situation and they had her in lots of pain. She couldn't do anything with it. So in any event, it's sad to see somebody like that cut down, and maybe all the more reason to watch it. So I highly encourage people to check out that.
That's awesome.
And I got a couple of videos I posted earlier, and it was the same video, just broken two bit parts. So there's a part one, part two version. If you go to my videos and search on most popular video, that's another way to find them.
Okay.
So I've definitely covered the topic there in terms of propulsion. So this idea that it's somebody from out there isn't necessarily the answer. In fact, I did another video. I didn't send you a link to it, in which I said UFOs not from up there. Something like that was the name of that video. Not from space. I put a question mark because I don't know for sure. But kind of in that video, I kind of go through if there were vast civilizations of space, some of the things that we ought to be seeing that we're not seeing.
Oh.
So that video is called UFOs Not from Space? Question mark. So, you know, I won't say they're not, but, you know, there's also talks of interdimensionality and things like that. So, you know, maybe these things are not, you know, some people say they're not human. I won't say they are or they are not, but if they are, because, you know, having direct proof is, you know, an engineer or a scientist needs direct proof of something, you know. A lot of people see a lot of things. A lot of people had a lot of experiences. I mean, that's something that when you got so much sight and so much experience, that's not something to ignore. But it's really weird. My own thinking is this is some. There's we may have some of this, but there may be some. I'm thinking angels and demons, to be honest.
Okay.
That's just my personal take on it. You know, that's just it's not something I can put in the bank. You know, so don't quote me on it. That's just an inclination I got based on so many things I've heard and seen over the many, many years. So I see a dark side to a lot of what's going on in the reported phenomenology. It's got me concerned.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people think we're going to have a fake alien invasion to take over the world and stuff. That one world government in that song you're talking about.
So I thought the song was sort of perfect. It's like Weird Al was way ahead of his time there.
Yeah. Well, I've done a few videos which I actually wear a tinfoil cap. It's an official tinfoil cap.
Nice.
Tinfoilcap.co. Yeah, I wear it for fun because it looks good. One of my buddies gave it to me.
See, and people think science is boring. The more people who study these kinds of things that we've talked to over the years, it's like, you know, the science people are really very funny.
We have fun. I mean, we can get serious. And, of course, there's some people are just always dead serious all the time. But for the most part, most of us are able to cut up and have some fun.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, it's really nice for the rest of us who really don't understand most of what you're talking about. It's really nice that there's a little fun we can fit in there.
Well, yeah, it keeps, you know, what? I got my Galactic Grace channel where I'm constantly talking, prepping topics and trying to urge people to prep. Well, to do that, you got to tell them how bad things can get, what can go wrong. which is easy to do when you also work from a safety standpoint where you got to think in failure space. And like the guy who creates something, he says, my baby can never be bad. You know, that's a prejudice that inhibits people from seeing the shortcomings in their own systems and designs. Like, you know, the guy with the Titan submarine, submersible, as he called it. But anyway, the situation is that, you know, it takes somebody from the outside to be able to see through a lot of this stuff. But, you know, when you're thinking in failure space, you have to consider what can go wrong. The worst thing can happen in this country, in my humble opinion, is an EMP attack. And I think an EMP attack is worse than a full-scale nuclear war. Everybody fears the nukes. I fear the EMPs, and here's why. Because a full-scale nuclear attack will take out the cities. Amen. Or if it's not aimed for the cities, it may be that they just aim them from the military bases. Whatever they hit and target, it's going to take them out. And then if they do ground bursts, it will be a good bit of fallout, like hardened facilities. If they can harden facilities, you're going to get fallout for hundreds of miles downstream, maybe further, if it depends on the size of the nuke. And, you know, how far away is that blasted is actually going to have effective range. And it depends on the size of the nuke, too. It may only be do damage maybe 7 miles away from the epicenter. Maybe if you live 12 miles away from the epicenter, if you're not downrange from the radiation, you're probably going to be okay from the blast itself. Now, if we have an EMP, the whole nation's infrastructure goes down, and that could be brought down with a nuclear attack, and the nuclear plants will have EMPs that are local. And I would think that they would probably EMP the whole country before they launch it anyway. But an EMP alone means you lose electricity. Okay, yeah, I live without electricity. I'm fine and happy. I'm off grid. Ain't going to affect me. Well, you got to worry about all the risk. One, your days of going down the store and buying a tank of gas are over because they require electricity to pump it. The trucks that deliver it are also running from fuel that require electricity to pump it. The spare parts keep the trucks running. Come from being ordered out of parts stores, which all the logistics are on computers now. The days where you go in a parts store and the guys had a shelf full of big books on the counter, thumbing through them to find a part, that's over. Everything's on a computer. If you want to pay for, you know, something to get a piece or a part, well, the money in the bank is all electronic now. So what money you got in pockets on the real money you got, that and gold and silver, whatever you can barter. But think about this. No more water is going to be pumped. No fuel is going to get pumped. Communications will be gone. Society will break down. The EMP, the Congressional Task Force and MP, back over a dozen years ago, reported that 9 out of 10 people would die from societal collapse within a year. And a lot of that is due to disease because you're not pumping water. The sewage is not being treated. The sewage is going to back up. Cholera, dysentery, diseases, beer hoard, starvation. But I hate to tell you, that report was very optimistic because they forgot to factor in a couple things. One is that we have these things called nuclear power plants over the country, and normally they got all kinds of safeguards and work great. When the entire grid system goes down and you can't get the fuel backup that would keep the backup generators running, which you're required to keep everything cool, you're in problem. Now, let's say somehow you save the reactors aren't a problem. Well, you still got all these spent fuel rod pools sitting outside the containment building. Some of them got the sheet metal roof over them. That'll be gone soon because what's going to happen is a typical spent fuel rod pool has a lot more nuclear material than probably a single spent fuel rod pool than all the nuclear warheads in the world. Because they have to be optimized for size and weight. But there you got just tons and tons of this stuff. All these fuel rods that come out of that plant over, you know, the last 5 to 7 years. And they're hot. They're very hot. Because the rods are so hot that they typically evaporate 160 gallons of water a minute.
Wow.
So it's not too bad. But when if you can't keep that water on, they evaporate. The water evaporates down. And when the fuel rods get exposed, they're made out of a zircaloy alloy. So alloy of zirconium. When it's hot and in contact with air, it burns. Now, I've had some nuclear engineer try to argue with me that, no, they won't burn, blah, blah, blah. The devil, they won't. I got reports from Sandia National Laboratories that show where they test this stuff, and it all burnt and slap up. So, yeah, it burns. And what happens when your fuel rods are burning, it's got this radioactive fuel in it. Well, guess what? It's releasing that fuel. All that's going up in smoke. And what don't is going to fall down the bottom of the pool and collect together, and all the water is going to evaporate out, and it's just sitting there radiating and emitting radiation. Just that's going to burn for a long time, and then it's going to be down in the bottom of that pool, hot, making molten lava. Hopefully, it don't have enough purity to go critical and blow up. But so what you're going to have is vast amounts of radiation come out of these pools that will dwarf all the radiation from the nukes, and will also keep going for years, maybe up to 7 years, if this stuff will be emitting vast amounts of radiation going through our atmosphere, whereas the radiation from the nukes will mostly be gone for 2 weeks.
Hmm.
So I would say that's your bigger problem, is these spent fuel rock pools. We need to do something. We need to come up with some nuclear technology that reprocesses that. Of course, the uranium industry and all the industries that supply nuke plants are going to fight that, and they have in the past. But we got to overcome that because it's a national security, national safety issue that's not been well enough addressed. So I think Tom Poppick was the first person to identify this. I thought I was, so I discovered he beat me to it. I thought I was the first person to start ringing this bell. I discovered he actually covered it before me. So he's another guy in the EMP community. So the situation is that is dreadful, that's going to take out. And if you're living up there off-grid, you're going to be in trouble from that. And then somehow if you're, we got cesium-137 from Fukushima. But Fukushima got control really quickly because they had fire trucks that went in and pumped water over those spent fuel rods all the time into the reactors and everything. Of course, now they got a lot of water they're about to release to the ocean, pumping water on these things for years. But the thing is that these nuclear spent fuel rods will be a huge issue. You're going to get radiation all over the world. It may not be enough to get everybody, but the people that especially the heavier elements fall out closer to the power plant than the first 20 miles in any direction is going to be a huge problem. 25 miles, maybe up to 50 miles is going to be a problem. And it could be a problem everywhere just because there'd be so much of it for so long. Fukushima, what we got was very low level. But if you take 7 years of this stuff and we got 100 of these plants across the country, and then if it's a worldwide event, you got more plants around the world.
Oh yeah.
So I
remember Dr. Pry telling us that once that gets interrupted, once the grid gets interrupted, that pulling it, bringing it back up it's not like flipping a switch. We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, maybe you could kind of remind us about that. It's been a little bit since we spoke with him about that.
Happy to talk about that.
But that's a really critical thing that I think those of us who don't obviously deal with the power grid, you think, well, okay, they'll bring the power grid back up. But that was a monumental thing that once he started explaining it, it's like, oh, well, that just got farther away. We'll be right back. Our guest is Greg Allison, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
When the lights go out and you throw yourself about in the darkness where you learn to see. When the lights go out, don't you ever doubt the light that we can really be. When the lights go out, when the lights go out,
iconic happy news song. So before we talk about the bad news, we should talk about the happy news.
Yeah, well, we hope we don't go to the spirit in the sky before we get through a good life here.
Hey,
well,
Greg,
that's the problem now with this EMP thing. So what I talked about was the threat of these spent fuel rod pulls and how they will greatly affect everyone. So there's a couple other things people need to take into account, though. Then we'll talk about the grid, how vulnerable it is.
All right.
So why it takes so long to fix it. I know a lot of time's running down here, so I'll try to be quick.
It's okay. It happens all the time.
We run out of time.
That's why we did like a million shows with Dr. Pry, because every time we did it, it like opened up a whole new can of worms.
Can of worms.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, yeah. So we're covering everything from spirit in the sky to we don't want to die.
All right.
So this whole thing now is that other things will take people out that didn't get accounted for, and that 9 out of 10 people are going to pass away. What a lot of people aren't accounting for is an EMP, unlike the nuke attack, will take out most of the people in the cities. If the cities aren't nuked, these cities are going to have millions and millions and millions of starving people in it. And what are they going to do? They're going to pour out like an ant out of a fire ant nest that's been kicked hard, and they're going to scour all the countryside. So you're sitting up nice and pretty with your off-grid homestead, and suddenly you got hordes of what do you look like zombies attacking your homestead looking to eat every blade of grass and you. Because at that point in time, they're so hungry, you will be referred to as long pork. And that's the pork that walks on two legs.
Yikes.
Long legs, long pork. So, yeah, they're not just looking for your preps. You're looking like a pork chop. And I got a friend I nicknamed Lamb Chop a while back because I told her she lived up in upper state New York. I said, yeah, when the grid goes down, you're going to be a lamb chop. And she actually get picked up and moved to way out nowhere in Arizona. So she's not lamb chop anymore.
No, she's just going to be all gristly. She's out in Arizona.
She's got water.
Water.
They got
well,
good aquifer up in her part. It's up near, yeah, it's up in the northern part of Arizona.
Oh, okay. The nice part.
So, yeah, it's cooler there than even where I'm at in Alabama, believe it or not. Not like Phoenix. Phoenix is going to be one of them zombie zones.
Oh, yeah.
People and so hot. They'll be hot zombies. Anyway, so you got to take that into account. You got to take into account. And then the last thing that they didn't account for, they're saying, no, everybody on the farm is growing enough food, it'll be fine for the people out in the country. Well, no, not really, because if you go around, I did a video on my Green Greg channel where I surveyed farms. And I went for miles and miles driving around in South Georgia, which is very rural up here in North Alabama, and just driving by farms. That don't have a garden, that don't have a garden, that don't have a garden, that don't have a garden. I would go for miles and not see a garden.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at it from Google Earth, and I was seeing the same thing. Very few really have gardens that is tiny.
Or it's like the garden my dad did where everything turned into, I don't know, they had so much chard, they could have opened up some sort of weird chard distributorship. Nobody liked it, and they couldn't make it stop growing.
When I was a kid, everybody had gardens, big gardens, and they put food up, and they would have like 7 years worth of canned food on their shelves. And that's just how they did it. You know, it wasn't called prepping back then. It was just good old country survival. It was smart. It just meant smart. And that was just the way people lived once upon a time. Well, now everybody, you got 3 days worth of food at most in their home, the fat. And the grocery stores are just in time. And the farms, if you think they're going to be able to feed themselves, they're mostly growing market. I mean, well, most of the time the farmers are renting their land out, the big farmers. And what they're growing is wheat and soybeans and corn. Well, you don't go so far on that. And the sad thing about all those crops are growing, they're GMO seeds that they have to buy from Monsanto. They're not even allowed to store their own seeds anymore. They have to buy them so they can't even plant next year's crop. If they could, they don't have fuel to run their tractors. They don't have any pesticides, herbicides, or any of that stuff they used to grow with. So these farms are going to be vacant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some people got livestock, but will they be able to feed and hate or keep the livestock going? That's about the only thing around to eat. And livestock's going to go real fast because some zombies pouring out of the city will be sure to poach that stuff real quick. And if you think you're going to live with a high-caliber rifle going out and hunting, that's what I've heard a lot of people tell me. Well, and way back, you know, previous turn of the century when there were far fewer people and they had muzzleloaders, they wiped out all the game practically in no time flat. Anything bigger than a rat or a squirrel or a rabbit, and they got kind of sparse. Even the Great Depression, you know, rabbits got kind of sparse. So there's going to be so that kind of food ain't going to last. You know, what was that pigeon that used to fly over to the dark in the skies? The guys with muzzle loading shotguns drove to extinction.
Oh, Yeah,
yeah. Pigeon carrier. What was it called? Anyway, there used to be a pigeon that used to darken the skies. It just
the passenger.
Passenger pigeons, right?
Yeah.
Carrier
pigeons.
Pigeon.
We had to call a lifeline. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, it don't even exist anymore because a bunch of guys with muzzle-loading shotguns a long time ago just extincted them. And so this whole notion, people go, I got it covered, I'll survive. Not necessarily. Survival is going to be hard. It's going to be bleak. So I don't think, be honest, I think the survival rate, when it's all said and done, especially with the violence that will occur, will be somewhat south of 5%.
Wow.
It might be 1% or 2%. It's going to be bleak if this happens. This is why we need to harden our grid, and we need to make sure that somebody can't hit us while we're in the process. That's going to take a long time. They don't hit us with an EMP here in the next few years. Right? We're so close to having maybe a war with China over Taiwan. And China's come up with these ideal weapons. So one of the most vulnerable things, there's two things that are particularly vulnerable on the grid. The SCADAs, the supervisor control and data acquisition and computers, and one other thing, which for people out in the industry, they're kind of like a programmable logic computer, or a PLC. Some people that work in industrial society don't know what that is. But these computers that control pipelines, power lines, in big buildings, maybe HVAC systems. Factories use PLCs to control industrial equipment. But the SCADAs are real prevalent. They can be fried by the E1 part of the pulse. The most vulnerable thing, hardest to replace, is those high-power transformers. They weigh 200 to 400 tons apiece. They're as big as a house. There's only a handful of rail cars, and, I mean, you can count them on one hand, with the fingers on one hand, rail cars or trucks that can move these things. Yeah, you know, there were factories that built them, but they built them at a rate for, you know, we've had grid expansion and stuff like that. They're not there to rebuild everything if they could. And if they could build them, we don't have the means to transport them. But let's say, but if you ordered one today, let's say you ordered one, it would take you 18 months to get it on your loading dock, and then you got to install it. Well, see, by then, everybody's gone. Who's going to install it? But worse than that, the grid goes down. So you go, my transformer got fried by the EMP. So how you going to, you know, and it will fry the coils in. These coils are hand-wound coils. The coils, they use technicians that are highly specialized at doing this. Every one of them's hand-wound. The guys that do this are, you know, highly trained. South Africa tried to replace them. They thought, well, we'll build our own after they had got hit by a sodachrome mass ejection. And the ones they built last somewhere like 3 to 7 years, they fried. Just they weren't no good.
Wow.
They thought, well, we got this. We got engineers. We can do this. And didn't pan out. So if you lose all of these, you're going to be in serious trouble because it's going to take forever to get these things over if you could. The problem is, my transformer got fried. Well, let me call so-and-so. They're made mostly in China, South Korea, and Germany. There's a plant that makes some smaller ones down in Montgomery. But so if you want to get these things, you try to call the factory. Well, you ain't got a telephone. They're going to call them. They go on the Internet. Well, there ain't no Internet. Well, I'll find some way. I'll get money out of my bank. Well, there's no bank because all the money's electronic in the bank, too. So you ain't got the money to pay for it. You ain't got a way to order it because the Internet's done. Everything's over the Internet. And you ain't got a way to call them. You ain't got a way to go on the Internet and order it. If you could get in a canoe and paddle over there, because there ain't no fuel to run boats, because they need to pump that too. So if you get in a canoe or a sailboat and paddle over there to wherever you want to get your transformer from, say you could do it instantly,
yeah,
somehow. It would take you 18 months to get it. But problem is, if we haven't had a worldwide situation, if it's coronal mass ejection, if it's a solar coronal mass ejection, it could take out most of the ones in the world. So they may not be operating either. Your plant here in the United States is probably going to be operating because they got hit by the same thing that everybody else got hit by. So what are you going to do? How are you going to get these things? Where are you going to go? And if you get them, it'd be 18 months till you got it. And let's just say suddenly they had you multiply their technicians by several thousand so that they could, you know, stand up the rate. If you could order these things, if they had production facilities and everything was working, it would take you 10 years to replace them all if everything was working. But nothing's working anymore. And by the time you get them in, you got to have the labor force to install them.
Sure.
Get them. Well, your labor force is, you know, today, find labor to do anything. Today, right now. Well, find somebody to do something for you. I have the hardest time. I run a little farm here. I hire labor all the time, or try to. It's exceedingly difficult. And so what you run into is you can't find people today. Well, imagine what's going to be if, let's say, we'll take the optimistic approach, say only 9 out of 10 people pass away. Let's say that was pessimistic. Let's say if we only lose a third of the population or two-thirds, something like that. Where are you going to find the people to do the work? How are you going to get it done? And these are skilled workers, too. It's not just, you can't just grab somebody.
Well, and how do you even reach them? So you might have a guy who has a lot of skill, but the communication doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, there's no communications. And if you got it, how would you move it? Because you don't have the fuel to run the trucks. If you had the fuel to run the trucks, the spare parts it would take to maintain them. These trucks, trucks are in the shops all the time.
Yeah.
And they take, because they do a lot of heavy driving, the spare parts, the repair is not going to be available. So then everything breaks down. The whole society unravels. Everything. You're not going to be able to do Dinkum.
Yeah. And the more you think about it, the more things are missing in the puzzle. Hey, Greg, before we run out of time in the last minute and a half, Freedom Restoration Foundation, I'm going to post that. Can you give people a little elevator?
I'm president of that group. We got 1,000 members on our Facebook page. And then go to the Action Center page and scroll down past our alerts. I need a new webmaster. We need to update those. But if they go down past our alerts, it's got all kind of information about how to find your state and federal officials, how to contact them by phone, internet, what to say, how to do it, everything you need to know to take action. Because this is one of the things I'm big on is keeping our freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm big on securing the grid and keeping us free.
Well, you kind of can't go wrong there.
Well, some people don't agree with it. Some people think we shouldn't have a freedom of speech because freedom of speech hurts some people's feelings.
Well, yeah, we learned that at the fair. Yeah. Don't talk about how people become people because before they're born, they're obviously, I don't know what they are. Rabbits, walnuts, something. Yeah. They're not actually small little humans inside their moms. That was distressing for somebody.
Start breathing, right? I don't know. Those people are crazy. My youngest daughter was born 6 weeks premature, and she came out just fine. Didn't have to go in no incubator. Didn't need nothing. She was just fine.
Yeah, that's...
We're just going to have to, I think it is just a matter of letting people know that they're not by themselves and that there are other people who think like they do and that they're not actually crazy. And the information
direct people to my Green Greg's YouTube channel, my Galactic Greg's YouTube channel, the Freedom Restoration Foundation. We also got a group on Facebook.
Oh, yeah, I actually had that on there already. I had the Freedom Restoration Foundation on there. So, yeah, people can go click on all these links. They're all posted now, and the videos are on there as well. We have to run away because it's going to cut us off. Thank you so much, Greg. We've been chatting with Greg Allison.
Yep. Thank you, Greg, for coming on. We're going to do it again. We got
by the
Science
Bastion of Huntsville.
Yeah.
God bless you.
Lots more questions.
We'll be back next week. We the People Radio.us.
The world has to know it.